You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa ko pōtoku ingoe, no mai haere mai ki te wire mo tēnei rā. Kia ora, welcome to The Wire for Thursday the 1st of February. I'm Pearl Little, your host, and my producer Mac Smith is here also. Hey Mac.
Hey Pearl.
How are you going?
I'm great. Great to be here again.
Yeah, back together for one day at least. Coming up on the show today, Mac has a report about the new plan from the Green Party to revitalise Te Reo Māori in schools. The Opportunity Party is putting forward a candidate for the Mount Albert by-election. We'll have Andrew Little back for our weekly chat. And I'll also be talking to Emmy Rakete from No Pride in Prisons about the Corrections Department withdrawal from this year's Pride Parade. If you have any thoughts throughout the show, please don't hesitate to get in contact. You can call 309 3879 or text in on 5395.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
The debate over te reo Māori in schools has cropped up again, this time in the form of a new policy. I spoke to Green Party MPs Marama Davidson and Catherine Delahunty and President of the New Zealand Educational Institute, Linda Stewart. The Green Party yesterday revealed a new policy for the compulsory teaching of Te Reo Māori in public schools. The new plan was announced at Finlayson Park, a bilingual school in Manurewa. Māori Development spokesperson Marama Davidson says there are incredible benefits to bilingualism.
Learning a second and subsequent language for all children has, you know, long proven benefits for education across the board, especially for language development. It engages our brains, and particularly children's brains, in a way that exercises the brain and helps across literacy, top subjects, maths, English, but also across education. For Māori students, we definitely know that they do better when they are immersed in a culture, in an education, which does reflect their culture and language. I mean, the benefits are at all sorts of levels. Internationally, our economy, our trade has a global reach, especially also the Māori economy. Te reo is a point of difference in our, you know, as with any country, your heritage and native language always is. And we've even had, I think it's the CEO of Export New Zealand coming out in an article in the Herald this morning, adding support to all children learning Te Reo Māori for that very reason. Today in Aotearoa, Te Reo Māori is an added value and a requirement in so many different jobs, from community level, public sector, private sector. Hop off a plane from Air New Zealand today and you'll understand and you'll hear Te Reo being spoken. So, you know, it's more and more becoming a part of our everyday lives.
Davidson says the policy comes at a good time for the language, with progress in many areas already underway.
What I'm warmed by is lots of, including non-Māori people, who are sort of like, oh, about time, you know, and are out there advocating on the threads, on media threads, social media, who are aware that, you know, this should have happened a while ago. It's time that the government actually stepped up and played their role. After all, it was in schools that this language was literally beaten out of us, out of my grandmother's generation. And so it's in schools that will make a big difference to actually ensuring the survival of our language. So I'm really pleased. I'm really pleased about the high-level education sector support that is coming out, the teachers' unions, both of them, primary teachers' unions, principals, post-primary teachers' union. They're all coming out in support of this, as well as even traditionally conservative institutes. Maxim has also come out in support of all children learning Te Reo. So it's time, and the Greens are proud to sort of be part of the leadership that will actually step up and make this happen.
With three kids in primary school, Te Reo in public education is a personal matter for Davidson.
I like to support our local schools. Many parents drive across suburbs and across the other side of Auckland to get their children that Te Reo learning. In my local schools, my children haven't always been able to have anything except for basic te reo learning, and they've had to rely on my very, very limited reo to give them anything at all. And of course, I didn't have it at school. I had to learn it at university. So, you know, schools are a place where we can actually make this happen. And you're right, we could have done this some while back. It's going to take us some time to actually get our country and get our education system up to capacity. To, you know, so we've got to start now.
But the debate over compulsory te reo is not a new one. So what's changed? Education spokespersson Catherine Delahunty says it's down to a mixture of public backing and frustration at the government.
I think that we're leading on this issue because we think that it's been dragging on long enough. As the principal of the school where we launched the commitment yesterday said, Shirley Mahi said, you know, we've had this is a, te reo is a national language for a very long time. The Kohanga Reo movement built you know, a basic revival effort, but you know, government's not getting in behind it, and so the Greens have been working on it for quite some time. And I tried to get an inquiry at Parliament with New Zealand First into capacity to teach it last 2015. Government doesn't think it's a priority, but that's not what we're hearing from communities.
Okay, so there is public backing, you think, for this?
Well, I think it's growing, definitely growing. We've seen this anecdotally, of course, more and more non-Māori are interested in te reo Māori. Te reo Māori is, there's a new generation of people who value the language in a way that hasn't happened in when I was young. When I was young, people were still being hit for speaking te reo Māori in schools. I think there's an increasing valuing of the language. There's a lot more use of te reo in schools in a really, really varied and sometimes random way, because we don't have a workforce that's actually properly trained in te reo Māori. So people have an appetite for it now that I think, which is a good thing. And also we have perhaps 90% of Māori children do not have the benefit of going to kura kaupapa, and they really need the language in order to feel that their identity at school has been affirmed, and it helps their learning. It helps all children's learning.
It's also not just a matter of revitalising the language, but preventing it from dying out entirely.
We've only got perhaps 3% of Pākehā who have you know, reasonable capacity with te reo, and not much more than 4% of Māori, and that's really not how you revitalise a language. School is not the only place. The Crown has an obligation to make sure that the national language is taught in our schools, but there's a huge campaign which will be led by Hapu and Iwi, and that's where the real revitalisation effort will always be led, and so it should be. But the government has an obligation as part of that part of our te tiriti relationship to make sure that te reo is universally available in school. And really that takes workforce planning, and that's what hasn't happened. And that's what we're going to do this year, sit down with the experts and talk to them about how this could happen.
President of the New Zealand Educational Institute, Linda Stewart, says the task ahead may be a big one, but it has her full support.
What we've supported, and we've had this in our policy for a long time, is that we believe that te reo Māori should be a part of our everyday language, and it should be taught as a key part of New Zealand's curriculum. So we really welcome this call. What we are also saying is that we need to have some really strong professional development and training for teachers to make this possible as a goal. So we know that there's a real lack of fluent Māori speakers out in the sector, so we would be needing to encourage more of those people into our schools and our kura, and also we would be needing to really support our non-Māori teachers to be able to reach this goal. So there's work that needs to be done around it. But absolutely, this is our Indigenous language. This is the language of New Zealand, and it absolutely needs to be something that every child has the opportunity to experience and to learn. I think what needs to happen around it all is that there's going to need to be a plan around it, so that there's a planned approach to actually moving into this space so that we can normalise Te Reo Māori in our schooling. And also it's going to need some government investment. So those are things that are going to need to happen for it to work, but I think we absolutely welcome the move in this direction.
Stuart's confident that with the odd vocal exception, parents would be won over by such a policy. For 95BFM, call Max Smith, tēnē.
The Wire.
That was my producer Mac with his report on the new policy for Te Reo Māori in schools. We'll be back after this short ad break with Andrew Little.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Whakanakals, cock and piss. Balls. Thank you.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
Kia ora, you're tuned into The Wire. I'm joined now by Labour Party leader Andrew Little. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
That's great. Cool. So the election date has been announced, the 23rd of September. What is the Labour game plan for this year's election?
To work very hard. We're pretty advanced. Well, we are very advanced in our planning and preparation for the election, so I'm feeling very good about all that. Our priorities are going to be, and what we're going to be talking to New Zealanders about, will be about housing, about, you know, the opportunity for people, particularly young people, to get to afford to buy their first home, and also about the homelessness question, because the further consequence of an out-of-control housing market, apart from those who are trying to buy their own home, is that people who are reliant on rental accommodation can no longer afford rent, and that's why we have a massive homelessness problem. We're going to talk about health as well, because we know that with the health system having $1.7 billion cut in funding, that is affecting people's access to health, particularly elderly people and people in mental health services, and we've got to do something about that. And we're going to talk about education too, about what's happening in our schools, the fact that funding has been frozen, that schools are struggling to do the job that's required of them, and also the issue about, you know, the future of work and how we prepare for it, and the need for our 3 years free post-school education and training policy. Those are the priority issues that we're going to be talking about.
Yeah, right. And I mean, Bill English said that he wouldn't rule working out with New Zealand First in the next government. Are you open to this as well?
Yeah, I mean, we have a relationship with New Zealand First at the moment. They are one of the other opposition parties. But, you know, like other, you know, the great thing about MEP is you have multiple parties and you have common ground with some, but you have differences with everyone. And so it's a question about seeing, I think, where, you know, what the voters want to do, where the vote's for, and then you get the opportunity to see what you can pull together in terms of a government. But I think one thing that the Green Party and the Labour Party have committed to publicly and openly is that we are here campaigning for and fighting for a change of government.
Yeah, and so Bill English's National State of the Nation is happening today, almost in a matter of hours.
Right now, I think.
Yeah, it's going on right now. So, I mean, I guess he's expected to announce at least one new policy today. What do you think this is going to be?
I don't know. I haven't been told anything except what I have read from the pundits, which is they think there'll be something on housing. There's no question that they have completely mishandled the whole housing issue. They don't think that it's that serious. They don't seem to particularly care that there's just thousands of people who, you know, no matter how hard they work and save, they simply cannot afford to buy their home. And even the kind of the Home Start grant schemes that this government has set up, it is just nowhere near adequate to provide the level of support to get people owning their first home. So, oh, let's see what he says. But, gee, you know, for the last couple of years, they've had three housing ministers at the same, well, at the same time, doing different aspects of it. And yet we have record homelessness, you know, record low home ownership rates. Nothing seems to be working. So I'm very interested to see what they might say about it.
Because English was critical earlier this week of the Labour Green State of the Nation event on Sunday, that there were no policy announcement. What do you think the reason was the reason for this was?
For his criticism?
Yeah, for his criticism.
Oh, I think, I mean, you know, he's going to spend most of his time talking about other parties, because the truth is that after nearly 9 years in government, and let's face it, he was probably the second most important and powerful person in that government behind John Key. Now he is the most important. They have let a whole heap of things slip. You look at the information that came out yesterday. You know, we've now got 90,000 young people, 18 to 23-year-olds, not doing any, not in work, not in education, not in training, doing nothing. And that's an increase of nearly 20,000 in just 1 year alone. And you've got stagnant wages for a whole bunch of people. I mean, these are not the hallmarks of a successful economy. These are hallmarks of real failure. So, of course, he's going to talk about other parties and you know, call names and point fingers and stuff, but we're going to be campaigning on our responses to major problems that we know are there and that I think, you know, New Zealanders want to hear more about.
Yeah, of course. So just moving on, what are your thoughts on Bill English's response to the Trump immigration ban?
Weak and indecisive. You know, this is something we all started getting the news about this. Well, I first heard about it late on Saturday, and then, you know, it was all over the place on Sunday. It was Monday afternoon before we heard anything from Bill English, our Prime Minister. At that time, there was no information or clarification about, you know, those with dual citizenship, to the extent that that was a response to anything that President Trump was doing. But we should have heard from the Prime Minister much earlier, and he should have done what other world leaders, particularly Commonwealth country leaders, did, like Justin Trudeau, like Theresa May, should have called President Trump out on it, said this is totally unacceptable, this is racist, it's prejudiced, and it's not right. But all we got from this government was, you know, I think Murray McCully was the one, he said, oh, clearly the policy is having teething problems. What? You know, so as we have seen with this government so many other times, they just have no moral compass and no moral benchmark by which to judge things that are happening that you know, whether it affects New Zealanders directly or whether they're just a moral outrage. They just don't seem to care much about, you know, establishing New Zealand's reputation as a country that does care and has good humanitarian principles.
Right, and because obviously Bill English said it wasn't, he didn't think it was a racist one. Do you think this immigration policy is racist?
Of course it is, yeah. And that's, you know, President Trump promised a Muslim ban. This is the closest that he's got. I mean, he's identified it is about targeting those of the Muslim faith, and it is targeting a number of countries that are predominantly Muslim in terms of, you know, the faith of people in those countries. There are some countries that aren't listed. I mean, if this was about dealing with countries where there is support for or sponsorship of terrorism, then it's a pretty odd list, because Saudi Arabia doesn't appear on it, and yet, you know, they've been big backers of terrorist activity around the world. But there's no question this was racist, and if you have a look, you know, this wasn't about people who haven't been given approval to enter the US. This was actually stopping people who have visas and green cards and, you know, the right to study as students at their universities and colleges. They were the ones being stopped, either kicked off planes or detained in the US because of the country they came from or the fact they were Muslim. Yes, this definitely was racist.
And just going on for that, so Labour obviously recently has been supportive of doubling our refugee quota, but, you know, Trump's policy isn't just about refugees, it's also just about immigration in general. Do you think we, as a country, New Zealand, needs to accept more migrants?
Well, we certainly need to accept more refugees, because, you know, even lifting it to 1,000, which the government did, and that doesn't take effect for a while yet, that's not enough, and you know, we can take more, but not a lot more. 1,500 we can do, and we should be offering that kind of hand of support to people who are being persecuted and who need safety. In terms of the wider immigration question, the reality is at the moment, I mean, you know, we're a country dependent on immigration, right? We've always had people coming from other parts of the world, bring their skills and what have you here. Right now, we have major problems, particularly in Auckland, because we've had this rapidly growing population, you know, because of the significant increase in immigrants, and it is putting real pressure just on services in Auckland and on roads and stuff. And my view is we do just need to manage this much better, have a bit of a period of catch-up so we can kind of get, you know, good public transport systems in place, get traffic moving, and build the houses. You know, Auckland's 40,000-50,000 houses short of what it needs to accommodate the population that's there at the moment. It's not about saying, you know, no to immigration, but it is about saying, right now, at this point of time, we've got some real problems that we've got to take a bit of time to get fixed before we kind of carry on doing what we did before.
Right, and just lastly for today, what can you tell me about this new working future plan that Labor has announced?
Yeah, we announced that last year, at the end of last year. That's targeted at the young people who are not in work, education or training, and it's about offering them the opportunity. If they've been out of work for sort of more than 6 months and not doing anything, giving them the opportunity to get some work. So the idea is, work with DOC, work with other environmental organisations, work with local councils to get them into doing, environmental type work or work on the DOC estate or whatever. But actually just get some work habits and get some practical work skills. And if there's people who, one of the reasons they're struggling to get a job is they don't have a driver's licence, we'll put them on this program and we'll work with them and get them their driver's licence so they can get that under their belt. Helps them getting a job sort of later on. So, I've seen some amazing programs of organisations, actually a couple of private organisations, who are dealing with young people who've been out of work for a long time, and actually they've lost hope. They don't know where to go. They don't know how to get the training and the skills that they wanted to do. And they just take a bit of time to get some of the habits up and actually rebuild their self-esteem and their self-respect, and it makes a huge difference. And I just despair when I see that we have 90,000 young people in this sort of situation. That's not right, and I think as a government, you've got to bend over backwards to give young people an opportunity and a chance to get some basic skills and get on that sort of ladder to start getting ahead and getting their lives together.
Cool. Well, thank you for your time today, Andrew, and I'll speak to you again next week.
Look forward to it. See you.
Cheers. Bye. That was Leader of the Labor Party, Andrew Little, speaking to me just about some stuff that's been going on lately, I guess. Next up, we have a story from Mac about the new contester in the Mount Albert by-election.
Yes, that's correct. We obviously heard about the new Green Party policy, but also announced yesterday in the realm of politics was a new candidate for Mount Albert, and I filed this report. The Mount Albert by-election, initially thought to be a two-horse race between Labour's Jacinda Ardern and the Green Party's Julianne Genta, has now welcomed a third rival. Yesterday, just an hour before nominations closed, the Opportunity Party, headed by economist Gareth Morgan, announced its Chief of Staff Jeff Simmons would be running. Funnily enough, Morgan staged it right outside the Mount Albert Memorial Hall, where just this past Sunday, the Labour and Greens held their State of the Nation address. Simmons will stand in the vote on the 25th of February. Like Morgan, he's an economist, but he's also a Wellingtonian, so what's he doing running in Mount Albert?
I grew up in Auckland. I'm an old boy of Avondale College and Auckland University. So I've spent many years in Auckland. As Gareth said, my family is still in this electorate, and so I come back here often and would love the opportunity to live once again in the city of Sales if I could find some property I could afford.
Affordability aside, Simmons admits not only does he currently live in Wellington, he also won't commit to living in the Mount Albert electorate unless he wins. He says he may be a late start to the campaign, but current political trends leave room for surprise.
I think if we learnt anything from 2016, it's that, or even we learned it from the cricket at Eden Park the other night, there's no such thing as a foregone conclusion. Everything is up for grabs. There's no such thing as a safe seat anymore. And you might say that we're a little behind those international trends here in New Zealand, but I say that offers us a choice. Whether we go down the same path of partisan politics, alternative truths, and pandering to people's prejudices, or whether we strike a new path. And that's what the Opportunities Party is really offering here, a new path based on truth, transparency, and what works.
His vision includes addressing the usual suspects.
Spiralling house prices and rents, which are locking young people out of the housing market. Increasing that gap between rich and poor. We've got infrastructure creaking under the strain of rapid population growth.
But a fresh face one too, further emphasising their radical environmental policy, which includes a reduction in farming herd numbers.
And we've got sewerage in our swimming spots, raw sewage. I mean, firstly, but secondly, how are we supposed to lecture farmers that they should clean up their act if we can't do it in our largest city? So we think the people of Mount Albert are not getting a fair go. They're not getting a fair go in this by-election, and they're not getting a fair go in general. That is why Top is putting forward a candidate. It's why I'm standing in this by-election, so that the people can be offered a real choice. There are big decisions looming in this electorate in coming years, and local people need to be involved in those decisions. They need representation at the table, regardless of who the government of the day is.
All of this does come as something of a surprise, considering the unveiling of the Opportunity Party last year promised a list-only status. Although Morgan says this may not be the last time the party breaks away from such a commitment, it certainly won't see him standing.
We've got a couple of other people already who have come through who will create absolute havoc in a couple of electorates, so I would be a fool to say no, wouldn't I? Personally, I will never stand in it because I'm all about the policy at national level. That's all I'm interested in. I'm actually not interested in being a politician. In some ways, it's my worst nightmare, to be honest with you. My dream scenario would be that Labour or National say, well, that's great, Gareth, we'll do it all for you, and then I can go back to the beach. That would really be my happy scenario.
And, of course, Gareth Morgan's presence meant his call for the eradication of household cats had to be revisited.
I had two cats when I was growing up, and I can tell you, one of them in particular was an avid hunter, Tippy.
Simmons says, however, that the danger posed by other potential Tippies is not one that his campaign will focus on. For BFM News, Cormac Smith, Tene.
Around, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
That was Mac's report on the new contender for the Mount Albert by-election from the Opportunity Party. What was it like there on the day? What was the energy like?
I don't know that there was a particularly high level of energy. It was more just, a park up. They had one of their new vans, Make New Zealand Fair Again.
Interesting.
Their slogan kind of branded across the doors.
Yeah, I think that's a bit of an interesting slogan to go
it
with.
It is. In fact, there was a
considering
moment.
Considering the whole context.
Yes.
Yes.
The Trump play
yes,
on words. There
definitely.
Was a moment where Jeff actually said something about greatness, I think, making New Zealand great, but he didn't say again.
Right.
But Gareth did pick up on that when he came on later and
right.
said, no, we don't want to take that line. We're about fairness, not greatness. But, I mean, that whole slogan is kind of similar in that they want to go back to a time in New Zealand where we didn't have these levels of inequality.
Right, so a bit of a nostalgic sort of way of, campaigning, which is, obviously
totally.
Exactly what Trump did. It's that whole going back to this preconceived heyday, I guess. And I think it's really interesting that they're going through into this election with that slogan still and just in the midst of what just happened,
But and traditionally you've had Labour as kind of the harbingers of the welfare state.
Definitely.
But perhaps opportunity party will be presenting a different opportunity.
Definitely. All right, I've got a little track for you guys. This is Wood by Alice in Chains. You're listening to The Wire on 95BFM.
We'll be right back.
You're tuned into The Wire 95BFM. That was Wood by Alice in Chains. If you've had any thoughts about any of the stuff we've been talking about on the show today, maybe about opportunities, parties, new candidate in the Mount Albert by-election, or the Te Reo Māori initiative by the Green Party to be taught in schools from years 1 to 10, I believe. We'll be back after this with our final story about corrections being asked to not participate in the Pride Parade this year. BFM.
It's summer.
95 BFM.
BFM with you this summer. 95 SPF.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
You're tuned into The Wire on 95 BFM. So the Auckland Pride Festival Board has asked the Department of Corrections to withdraw its application to march in next month's Auckland Pride Parade. Corrections' presence at Pride events became contentious after a protest group, No Pride in Prisons, gatecrashed the parade, objecting to the department's staff for their treatment of transgender inmates. I spoke to Emily Raketeer about the action taken by the Pride Festival Board and started off by asking her to give me some background of the whole situation.
So for the past 2 years now, No Pride in Prisons has been making critique of the prison system in Aotearoa, particularly around the violence and racism that's directed by the prison towards prisoners. And part of that has been a specific critique of the treatment of transgender prisoners in New Zealand prisons. As kind of part of that critique, we've disrupted the Auckland Pride parades for the last 2 years because the Department of Corrections and the police have been invited to march. And this year, Pride has finally agreed with our position on corrections and has not allowed them to march. This has come out of a decision that was made at last year's Pride Parade, where corrections were told they had 1 year to produce a transgender prisoner safety plan and implement meaningful policy changes to protect the safety and well-being of transgender prisoners. And that has not happened.
Right, yeah, of course. And so how did that agreement come around at last year's Pride Parade?
As an organiser within the Pride and Prisons, I was invited to speak with the Pride Board and explain the critique that we had of the prison, that our critique of the Department of Corrections wasn't just some kind of wild emotional response that was backed by research and backed by analysis. And I explained that to the Pride Board and laid out some material steps which the Department of Corrections could take to protect the well-being of transgender prisoners. And the Pride Board let them march last year on the condition that they would implement some kind of plan, and they didn't implement that kind of anything really. They've made no material change since last year. And so they've been banned this year.
Yeah, right. So did corrections agree to make those changes in regards to their treatments of transgender prisoners?
Yeah. So they were only allowed to march last year because they said that they would have done something by this year, and they haven't.
Right, yeah. And as I understand, you guys had to occupy, what was it again?
It was this Department of Corrections Central Regional Office. So part of what No Pride in Prisons does is we have a number of advocates who work with prisoners in New Zealand prisons. When these prisoners are experiencing human rights abuse, we take whatever steps are necessary to rectify that and to improve their conditions. And so we occupied the Department of Corrections Central Regional Office in Hamilton on behalf of a transgender woman who had been put into solitary confinement against her will for her own safety.
Right, yeah, which I mean completely goes against any changes that corrections said they would make, obviously. Also, has corrections responded to the Pride Parade Board asking them to withdraw their application?
They actually, I thought this was quite unprofessional of them. They actually just posted a comment on one of the news articles about it, which I thought was a kind of telling example of how bad they are at doing their jobs. But yeah, they basically just what they always do when their human rights and abuses are pointed out, and that was just to lie about how hard they're working and say that they have a really hard job and they're doing their best. But the fact of the matter is, this is not an isolated example. Prisons aren't only failing to protect the human rights of transgender prisoners, and everyone else in prison is doing fine. The reality of the situation is that when the Ombudsman, who are the government's independent complaints investigation service, investigated a random sample of New Zealand prisons, they found that every single one of those prisons was breaching the UN conventions against torture. Medical neglect, sexual violence and abuse were found in every single one of those prisons. So this is one particular example of one particular class of prisoner who are being abused and subjected to the worst excesses of the violence in New Zealand prisons. But that's a universal problem, and that's why No Pride in Prisons advocates for the absolute and unqualified abolition of prisons in Aotearoa.
Yeah, of course. And I mean, Will like any sort of corrections department, do you think, have a presence still at Big Gay Out that's also coming up this month?
Yeah, I'm not sure, actually. I haven't thought about it. It's possible.
Yeah, because, I mean, I understand, you know, obviously, as it's a public event in a park, blah, 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 whatever, there is sort of, like, some police presence, you know, like you'd have at a festival or a whatever. But would you guys sort of like to see that not happen? Are you opposed to that? Or is that sort of, like, a different issue, do you think, as, like, in comparison to them actually marching in a parade?
Yeah, I think if the Department of Corrections does have a presence at Big Gay Out, they'll be there to recruit. They're pushing for a massive increase in staff at the moment because a series of policy fuck-ups made by Judith Collins has massively inflated the prison population and they don't have enough staff.
Right.
That's something that we're opposed to, and we're opposed to them recruiting anywhere because they shouldn't exist, let alone have an increased payroll. But it's definitely not a priority for organisation.
Yeah, of course, definitely.
If I could just kind of promote something for a second. No Pride in Prisons has organised an event called 10,000 Too Many, which is a public march taking place on Saturday, 11th of February. We're meeting outside Altair Square and marching up to Mount Eden Prison to hear public speaking about the fact that the prison population has reached a completely unprecedented 10,000 people.
Can anyone explain why the modern day whales are so big?
The Wire.
That was Emily Rakete from No Pride in Prisons talking about corrections being asked to not participate in the Pride Parade this year. Got an interesting text in from a listener saying that corrections just doesn't get it. They say they're disappointed about being excluded from the Pride Parade because they have these new plans for the safety of LGBTQI prisoners. Their plans are to allow them to hold on to things that allow them to feel like the gender they identify with and single cells, i.e. solitary confinement. They're not saying they're going to treat them like the people they are and the gender them appropriately. Thank God they're excluded. Also, someone else asking if we're still getting Jason on for State of the States. We are. He has just recently switched over jobs. He now works for BuzzFeed, and as I understand, it's very hectic being a journalist over in the US at the moment. So he still is a segment on our show. It's just that this week he had to quickly leave on assignment, but he should be back next week and the weeks after that. But thank you for your text. This next track is Contact by Mick Harvey. Contact. FM, you're tuned into The Wire. That was Contact by Mick Harvey. Also interesting, just coming off the last interview with Emily from No Pride in Prisons, talking about how Corrections is trying to boost their employment, their numbers, and how many police they have. Bill English has just announced that he's putting over $500 million into boosting police numbers as one of his first speeches at Prime Minister. So a bit of interesting timing there.
That was The Wire.
So that's the end of our show for another week. Thank you to everyone who spoke to me today. Marama Davidson, Catherine Delahunty, Linda Stewart, Gareth Morgan, Jeff Simmons for being in the Opportunity Party report, obviously. Andrew Little and Emily Rakete. A big thank you to my producer, Mac Smith. Will you be here again next week, Mac? No, you won't.
I won't, but maybe one time in the future again.
One day, but we'll have another producer next week. And of course, thank you to all the listeners for tuning into The Wire this week, and thank you to everyone that texted in. I really appreciated your opinions. Yes. Sigrid is up next to the 1 to 4.